Hi, this is Hugh Cornwell, and welcome to this Mr. DeMille FM podcast. If you have any comments, suggestions, or simply want to get in touch, then please email info@mrdemillefm.com. This episode is an interview with Paul Cook, drummer of the Sex Pistols and the Professionals, and a self-confessed film fan. I hope you enjoy the show. Well, I'm sitting here with Paul Cook, erstwhile drummer with the Sex Pistols, and now with the Professionals, his new band. And Paul's got some very interesting choices of his films, and I've got some very curious questions for him to ask him about some films that he has had some sort of connection with in the past over the years.
Oh, yeah.
But the first thing I want to ask you, Paul, is can you remember the first film that you saw in the cinema?
I can, yeah. In the cinema, that will be Lawrence of Arabia, I believe. What a great film.
Who took you to see that?
My dad, who comes from the war generation, he loved all those old David Lee. Took me to see Zulu and Bridge on the River Choir, Lawrence of Arabia, all that stuff when it came out. I was quite young, and I just remember the scale of it and, you know, the first on the big screen watching this world of sand and people flying across
In
beautiful Technicolor. It took me to another world.
What a choice. You're so lucky.
Yeah, last an impression, yeah.
I think mine was El Cid, which wasn't quite... spectacular, but it wasn't... Lawrence of Arabia's got a special magic about it, the way it's...
Yeah, and I still watch it again now. If it comes on, I tell you, you start with these films, I've seen them a million times. You start watching it and you're just... Next thing you know, 2 hours has gone by and you're watching every minute of it again.
I was looking up some facts about this film. Marlon Brando and Albert Finney, they both turned down the Lawrence role. And Brando said he didn't want to spend 2 years riding a camel. That's why he turned it down. And it was 3 years in the making, over 3 years.
Really?
Yeah.
But what a great choice, though. You say Brando didn't want to do it. It made Peter O'Toole as an actor, didn't it? And he really looks like, I don't know if you know, he looks the image of T.E. Lawrence, I think.
Is that right?
Yeah,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, if you've seen pictures of him.
And there's a list of his injuries that he sustained when he was making the film. Third-degree burns, both ankles twisted, torn ligaments in hip and thigh, broken thumb, dislocated spine, fractured skull, camel bites, sprained neck, torn groin muscle, and he was concussed twice.
Oh, brilliant. Blimey. It sounds like he's training with the SAS about doing a film, really. That's amazing.
The scene I remember immediately whenever anyone mentions this film is the long shot where Sheriff's riding in from the desert and you just see this pile of dust as he comes, and the camera's still, and he just rides this really long shot.
Yeah, it goes on and on.
Slowly he emerges. It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah, the scene that really sticks in my mind as well, there was a scene where you see the desert and the dunes of it and the ship going by in the background because there was a river over the other side. And it looked like, I thought, how do you get a ship in the desert?
Thank you. moving on from you going to see Lawrence Arabia with your dad, did he take you to the cinema a lot?
No, he didn't, actually. He wasn't a big cinema goer, my dad, but he went to see all those films, I remember, or if there was a really good war film out, stuff like that.
Right, right, right.
I don't remember him taking me to... What would be a war film around those times? Well, Bridge on the River Kwai, yeah, stuff like that. He loved all that old stuff.
Yeah.
But he wasn't a big cinema goer.
Yeah.
When I was a real young kid.
I want to go back a long way, actually, and ask you something that I've always wanted to ask somebody who knew the answer to this.
Oh, go on.
What was Who Killed Bambi? Was that some sort of a film project at the beginning that never got completed? Or what? Can you tell me something about it?
I reckon I could, yeah.
Great, please.
Yeah. Who Killed Bambi was the... going to be the original title of the Pistols film, which turned into The Great Rock and Roll Swindle.
Right.
That was the original screenplay called Who Killed Bambi. But that wasn't... It's just simply, it wasn't used as a title, really. That's all. We had a song in there, which Tempo Tudor sung, called... There's a song called Who Killed Bambi.
Right.
And what it meant is Malcolm's lyrics... And yeah. Who wrote the song? I can't remember. Him and Julian Temple wrote it, maybe. And
right.
It's about who killed Bambi. It's who... I don't know what Malcolm was going on there. Who killed the rock god? Who killed the Pistols? Who killed whatever, you know?
So the script stayed the same, just the title was changed.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Okay.
Well, that was, Russ Mayer at that time was going to be the director.
Right.
Did you know that?
Yes, I knew that. Well, I forgot that in connection with The Great Rock and Roll Swindle, but I couldn't find a record of the connection between Who Killed Bambi that.
Yeah, but that was the name of the project when Russ Mayer was involved, but he only lasted a couple of shoots, a few days shooting, and it all fell apart.
Did shoot with him?
I think he did take a couple of days shooting, and whatever happened, probably fell out with Malcolm, like everyone does, and he was sacked, and so they changed the name of the project straight away.
I see, yeah. Now, you mentioned... Julian, who ended up directing The Great Rock and Roll Swindle. And I always remember Julian as being the sort of the punk... he was the intellectual, wasn't he? He was the one that was very... I remember having dinner with him back in the day, and he's being very, interested in all the philosophy behind punk and all this. And is that how you remember him as well?
Not really. I knew about Julian when he came in, got involved after Russ Mayer left the project.
The first time you met him?
To finish off the Rock and Roll Swindle, And he seemed like a proper film, film buffy type of guy, pretty posh.
Yeah.
I don't know if he was intellectual. Maybe he is, maybe he isn't. Who knows? And we got on all right with him. And, of course, Malcolm fell out with him again during the project, during the Rock and Roll Swindle. That all went tits up. And it ended up... I don't know who finished that film off in the end, to tell you the truth, but... Malcolm... That's right, Julian did finish it off, I think. Malcolm walked away, and I think Julian finished it off in the end.
Good for him.
Yeah, but we got on all right with Julian. He's a good guy.
I had to do. I saw it through.
So, Paul, the second film you've got on your list of choices is Hitchcock's classic Psycho. What is it about Psycho that particularly you're drawn to?
Well, I remember it when I was, because I was so young when it was first shown on the TV. Lawrence of Arabia was my first cinema experience. Yeah. And I think being terrified watching Psycho when I was a young kid as well, my dad let us watch it. So I can't remember how young I was. And I remember being behind the sofa and just being totally scared out, scared out of my wits. And that's why I've got it on the list, actually, because it's one of those films.
You'll never forget.
Never forget it. It left a big impression. And I've seen it again many times. Everyone knows all the famous scenes and that. Yeah. But it's just brilliant. Yeah, and I saw them. They show Hitchcock all the time.
Yeah.
And I saw the North by Northwest the other day, and you just think, oh, what amazing actual certain scenes in them, that which are iconic, you know, scenes.
Yeah. I've been looking up some things about Psycho, and this is very funny, that an angry father sent a letter to Hitchcock saying that his daughter refused to take a bath after she saw the film Diabolik, which was made the year before, a French film. And now, after seeing Psycho, she refused to take a shower. So he was very angry. So Hitchcock replied saying, send her to the dry cleaners. And the shower scene took 1 week to shoot.
Right.
Which is incredible, isn't it? I mean...
I've read that before. So all the different angles. You can see why all the different the shots of the blade coming down. And
so many shots. And it earned 40 times its budget, which is amazing.
Right.
And it was Hitch's highest grossing film.
Well, it's funny you say that about she won't take a shower as well, because I remember when being on the road in America, when we used to do low-budget tours, stopping off at these little motels, and the first thing you think of is Psycho.
Now, looking down again after Psycho, we've got a lovely choice here, which is the Lavender Hill Mob.
Right.
Now, I'm a big Alex Guinness fan myself. And can you tell me about your love of this film?
I can. Yeah, again, growing up, you don't go out, never went out much when we were young kids, really. Winter Sundays, there'd always be one of these films on the TV, like The Lavender Hill Mob or Passport to Pimlico, all those great Ealing comedies, or even a Norman Wisdom film and all stuff like that. And I used to love all those films, just sitting there, and like you say, Alex Guinness as well. And it's just a moment in my childhood that brings back those, you know, cosy Sunday nights or afternoons sitting in front of the telly.
The story
of it is brilliant as well. The screenplay is fantastic, you know, about the gold bullion robbery and making the Eiffel Towers and then chasing the girl around who's got them. And it's brilliant. And at the end, he ends up in Brazil, is it? In Rio or something. And he gets carted off in handcuffs. It's just great from start to finish.
And in fact, Audrey Hepburn made her film debut in that. She's got a tiny part. And Robert Shaw and Frank Forsyth, the film debuts of all of them in that film, which is amazing, isn't it?
Wow, and also they had this great Sid James and Alfie Bass in there.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Can't beat it.
Had them all in there, yeah.
Now, have you heard of a film called The Squeeze?
I have heard of a film called The Squeeze.
A very unknown, sort of underrated English thriller, isn't it?
Yeah.
With David Hemmings and Carol White. And I heard that your bandmate Steve Jones made a cameo appearance in it totally by accident. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, it's really funny. They filmed that film. It was all around Portobello in the '70s and the mid-70s, it must have been about, I'm not sure, 73, was it?
While the carnival was on, or...?
No, just around the market, all around there, and I think the film was all based in West London. And I remember Steve said one day, they were filming a film down there, and we went to see it, totally by accident, next year, I think, when it came out, and we're sitting there, and... There I am. That was the film. He's like walking along in the back, trying to be in it as well, obviously, Steve Jones.
He
sees a camera, he wanted to be there, so he's walking along trying to get in the shot. And he was. It's really hilarious.
It's a great little film. I really enjoyed it. Now, I've got a story about Steve, which I want you to substantiate if this is true or not. I'll tell you the story and you tell me if it's true. I heard that on a drunken night out, he was in some club in London, and Eric Clapton was quite fond of him because he thought he was good fun. And Steve passed out, and Eric said to the people there, "Don't worry, I'll look after him." And he took him home and put into bed, you know, completely comatosed. And then in the morning, Steve woke up in a completely white room with guitars on the walls, and he thought he'd died and gone to heaven. Then he suddenly realised he was alive and picked one of the guitars and climbed out the window with it. Now, is there any truth to this, or is it being completely made up by somebody?
That's a great story. I've never heard it.
That's amazing.
I've never heard it, but it's a great story. I don't think it's true, alas, but...
No.
He has been in many rooms where he's walked out with a guitar, though. I don't know if he was in Eric Clapton's white room. And, I'll have to ask him. He hasn't told me if it has been. He's been in a lot of situations like that along the years, I'm sure.
Now, did you grow up with him, or is this... Yeah.
We did, around West London, went to school together, everything. Yeah, we've known each other since we were...
Yeah.
8, 9, 10, something like that.
And you keep regularly in touch still?
Yeah, we do. He's
great.
In Los Angeles, and doing his stuff. We do.
So the next film we got on the list is That'll Be the Day, one of David Putnam's first productions, of course. And tell me something about your fondness for this.
Well, that was when we were just getting into the idea of forming a band, actually, when we were sort of, we must have been teenagers, 15, 16, when that came out, something like that. And it was a, kind of the first film that was made about music. Really. There weren't many films, as you know, there weren't lots of films being made about music around that time.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it just struck a chord with us, really. A kid just getting fed up with his home life, getting a guitar and running away, fantasy world, you know, it seemed magical to us, I guess. Well, to me anyway.
An attractive existence.
It did, yeah. And it was a good film as well. And the music was great in it and the performances were good. And like I say, there weren't many music films about at that time. So, and it was a very big film at the time because David Essex, as you know, was a massive star.
Yeah,
Great records he made as well. And Keith Moon was in it and Billy Fury as well, the great Billy Fury.
Right.
And, you know, the cast was great.
Yeah. And how long after seeing that film was the Pistols your first band?
Yeah, it was, yeah.
So how long after that did that start to take formation then?
We was into very much into music at the time when That'll Be the Day came out. So I know it was a few years later when we actually, we were learning our instruments around that time. Pistols didn't form for another few years after that, yeah.
Well, let's hear from Billy Fury.
Astoria, the scene was changing. Bingo and Rock were pushing out X-Raiden. We were the first band to vomit in the bar and find the distance to the stage too far. Meanwhile, it's getting late at 10 o'clock. Rock is dead, they say. Long live rock.
Now, the next one here is a real nice choice you got here, The Asphalt Jungle, which is John Houston's great film noir. Now, tell me something about this.
Well, again, I was a bit older by this time watching all these films when they come on. And it just, I looked at the film, I thought, this is something different. I haven't seen this type of film before. As you just said, film noir, didn't know anything about film then. And it was all dark, you know. And again, it was just a great story. The caper, the heist, if you like, with Sterling Hayden.
Yeah.
And the acting was fantastic. Superb, in it as well.
Yeah.
It was all great. It was Sam Jaffe, is it? Or Jaffe, did you say it? And Marilyn Monroe, one of her first appearances.
That's
maybe
right.
Maybe the first. And everything about it was right again. And it was kind of new. That's what attracted me to it. Really. I've never seen a film like that before, what people call film noir now.
Yeah. And the producer, Louis B. Mayer, he said the film was full of nasty, ugly people doing ugly things.
Yeah, there you go.
And Marilyn Monroe apparently screen-tested twice for the part.
It had everything, didn't it? I think it won a lot of awards as well.
Yeah.
Nominated
for a few Oscars.
Yeah, and all that stuff, yeah. Deservedly so, yeah.
So now, going from an American classic film noir, we're going to a very experimental English thriller performance, which, again, shot around a lot of it in West London, by Nick Rogue. So, why is that here?
Oh, again, why is it something different? I mean, I liked sort of films that sort of not run in a mill, I guess, And you say, as you say, it was filmed around West London, Fulham area, was it? And I just like the way they mix like the gangsterish Fulham crowd in with the rock and roll world and the seedy Notting Hill Gate underworld and that. And the story,
two different worlds.
Yeah, and the story is so far out there as well. You know, you can make up your own conclusions. You know, James Fox, a gangster who gets involved in that.
Yeah.
See the underworld of the ex-rock star and stuff like
that.
Yeah,
loads of drugs floating around.
Loads of drugs, yeah, and he's freaking out. And
yeah, discovering his true identity and all, and who he is and all this.
All that stuff, yeah. And as you know, the making of the film has become legendary as well over the years with all books and everything being written about it. And he said, she said, who done this. And I think the making of the film was pretty troublesome as well, by all accounts.
Yeah.
I think that house is still there, maybe down Power Square as well.
My engine pumping steam, and I was grinding at you hard to fast. I was burning.
doctor who was telling me my cold would never last. When the fire in my boiler quit before I came, there ain't no epicenter need a gone damn train. Once was at a time when I could mama shave on dry and raise a few old nights down chill. Waiting at the station with the heavy loaded sack, saving up and holding just a spin. Shooting a supply from my demon's eye, instead of waiting for time to hope I will. When the fire in the boiler up and quit before I came, there ain't no empty cell, I need a gone dead train. Yes, a gone dead train. Got to help it to burn. You know it's a gone dead train. You got to teach it to learn. For some jelly roll, there ain't no switch been made. You let a juicy lemon find a spring to run a dry well for. In the fire in my boiler up and quit before I came. There ain't no empty cell, I need a gone dead train. Yes, a gone dead train. Got to help it to burn. You know it's a gone. So go.
Your list, Paul, is quite fascinating because you picked real original films that are very perfect examples of certain sort of
genres
yeah. in film.
Yeah.
And you picked perfect examples of them, like That'll Be the Day. Not many rock music films were being made, and that was one of the first, you know. And Performance was breaking ground. These are groundbreaking films. And the next one was probably one of the most groundbreaking films that has ever been made in England, A Clockwork Orange.
Oh, right, yeah.
So tell us about that.
Well, again, fascinating story. Yeah, it's Kubrick as well. He could have chosen quite a few Kubrick films, I guess. Big fan of his film-wise over the years. But that was the first one I'd seen of his, I think. And again, it was just so out there, futuristic. Never seen anything like it. And you had to be quick, actually, to see it at the time because it was banned.
Yes, after a very short time.
Yeah, after a very short period. And yeah. And I couldn't believe after that we heard it was all filmed around Milton Keynes or somewhere like yeah. that, where he lived. And it was just brilliant, the style of it, the concept, the violence. All right, you know, there's a lot to be said about that. But yeah. Just the space age, you know, the futuristicness of it all. And it still seems like today, if you see it today, it's still like it's set in the future, amazingly.
Which is very good if it yeah. can stand the test of that time, because it was made in the sort of 77.
And the dialogue as well, it was all like, it really struck a chord with a load of kids. All went around, started talking like that, even dressing like that.
Yeah.
And they still do, actually, some people.
I've looked up, I've got a few things here about it, which is quite interesting. Kubrick actually removed it from distribution. It wasn't banned, he removed
yeah.
it. It was due to, there were some copycat killings and he was receiving death threats and right. he got very worried about the effect it was having on the society. Right. So he pulled it. And then it wasn't released again until just after his death, in this country, that is. I think
you could see it abroad. I yeah. remember going abroad later on. You could see that everywhere in France and stuff.
Yeah.
But it's easy to understand with the gang mentality and the cults of the UK, you know, how that would take place, like with yeah. mods and rockers, skinheads and all that, how yeah. people would latch on to that
yeah.
and do this. Yeah, pretty scary, really.
And it was the first film to use Dolby sound.
Ooh.
And most of the film was shot in natural light. And Mick Jagger had bought the rights to the book as a vehicle for the Stones originally, apparently.
Really?
And then he sold the rights on to Ken Russell, who was going to make it, with Oliver Reed playing Alex. Which I can just see, yeah. Really.
Yeah.
And Kubrick wanted Ennio Morricone to do the score, so he rang Sergio Leone, and Sergio Leone told him that he wasn't available, which was a lie. So he could have had him. But he didn't like the idea of, he thought Morricone's...
He used all classical in the end, didn't he?
Beethoven, yeah, most stuff. Of it.
Yeah, most of it, yeah.
And then Wendy Carlos, who was born William Carlos, he changed his gender. When Wendy Carlos done quite a lot of film scores. She did the main theme and a few other bits and pieces, but most of it was classical, yeah.
Yeah, I went to see that the Kubrick exhibition on in Kensington at the Design Centre, was it? Last year. It was just great stuff. There were all these old stuff, film scripts, everything, and all these films that he'd done over the years and stories behind them, and it was fascinating.
Yeah. Anything about Clockwork Orange that came up that you can remember?
It was just, what I've touched him, really. I mean, we all know how long these films took to get together and how meticulous he was. In fact,
this was one of the quickest he'd ever done, apparently.
Really?
From beginning to end, he did it all within a year, and it was out within a year, which is amazing for him, apparently.
Yeah.
Fastest film he ever made.
I can imagine, yeah, 5 years.
As soon as he started it, he probably wanted to end it immediately.
Yeah. Yeah. So he didn't show that all his life. He wouldn't let it be released all his lifetime.
No, that's right.
You're saying they only released it after he died.
Yeah.
Over here again.
He asked for it to be pulled, in the UK.
No, you never see it on the TV or anything, do you, really? It's like...
No, it's still sort of neglected, really.
It's a bit touchy still, isn't it?
Yeah.
Amazingly, yeah.
Paul, I wanted to ask you what your opinion is of the film Sid and Nancy, and if you've seen it, I'm sure you have, I mean, I thought it was, you know, Gary Oldman's is really his first film role, apart from a Mike Leigh film called Meantime, which was the TV film. And he did an amazing job, I think. I mean, I didn't know Sid that well. I've met him a couple of times, but he was so on it. Amazing portrayal, I thought. And were you involved at all with that film?
No. Okay. Wasn't, in one word. And do you want me to tell you in one word what I think of it as well?
Yes, do.
No, I won't. I'll leave you to guess. But I think you touched on it all there. All that was good about the film, as far as I can see, was Gary Oldman's performance, which was uncanny, really. Yeah. How he got to be, he was like Sid Vicious in the film. Amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, all the guys that played the rest of us, just like comic strip cartoon characters, really, and it's very cringy. And
how did they manipulate the truth at all in the to make the film, or change a lot of, you know, important things?
It was generally pretty crap. I don't know. I mean, that was a part of Sid's life. I wasn't with around him at the time. At the end, you know, mainly when he went to New York and when all the decadent stuff was going on. So, and, you know, Nancy and all that stuff. So, I don't know. I'd have to watch it again. I haven't seen it for such a long time, really. Maybe I might think it's a bit better than I initially thought.
Thank you.
Here's a nice choice. Ken Loach's Kez on your list. So tell me about the story of the boy and his pet kestrel bird.
Yeah, well, I saw this film much when I was much older, actually, Kez. It wasn't when I was a kid. I know it was out in the 60s, but I didn't see it when I was younger, when I was old. And it just struck a chord with me because it just showed me kind of what life was like up north a little bit, I guess, because we come from London. You didn't think any world existed outside of London when you
different
were growing
world,
up.
Yeah,
yeah, and you just thought, oh, God, there's these people up there who are just like us, kids out, you know, being bullied by his brother and a horrible life. And not that I had a horrible life, but it's same sort of feel, really, but just knowing that there's another world outside of London and, you know, you really felt empathy for the young kid with his only mate was his kestrel and stuff and the scene on the football pitch as well and all that. It was just great, and I really got into, like, after that, checking out all the Ken Loach stuff, what he done, and which is marvellous as well, you know. So there was a way into his filming as well, which I liked. Yeah, so I generally guess it was just that desolate northern background and kids growing up like we were very much in London, you know, scruffy kids running around trying to make mates with everyone.
Here's another dark one, Blue Velvet. I mean, another groundbreaking film. Probably a lot of people think it's David Lynch's masterpiece. So very atmospheric. Dennis Hopper with the oxygen mask. Nasty, nasty. Yeah. So what do you like about this one?
You've got to have a sick mind, really, haven't you, to be attracted to Blue Velvet, I would imagine. No.
It's very romantic, though. It's a romantic film,
it
wasn't
it? Yeah, it is as well. I know. It just showed me again a side of life that I'm not familiar with, the real dark side of America. Which, when you go there, eventually later on, you find out this kind of does exist, this kind of thing. You know, yeah, everyone thinks it's far out there, what's going on. And it is a little bit over the top, obviously, with Dennis Hopper and the storyline and all that.
Yeah.
But there is that kind of dark side of, you know, cities in America that are like that. Quite scary, really.
Yeah, under the surface.
Yeah, but I was just fascinated by the madness of it all and the David Lynch, you know, obviously... Yeah. film which is going to be like that, but just because it was so different as well, I guess it was pretty dark though. Yeah.
She wore blue velvet, bluer than velvet was the night. Softer than satin was light from the stars. She wore blue velvet, bluer than velvet were her eyes, warmer than May her tender sighs. Love was all. Bye.
So, Paul, here you go. Paul Anderson's first feature film, The Royal Tenenbaums, a wacky American tale about a family. Tell us about this, what you like about this.
What you just said, really, a wacky American tale about a real totally dysfunctional family. It's absolutely brilliant on every angle. The acting, and it's superb, and just the different pockets of the family and all what's going on. I think everyone can relate to that. I think everyone's got a little bit of that in their family somewhere. And soundtrack was great as well. All the acting's great. And it's just a bit bonkers, really. I just kind of like films that are off-centre a little bit, really, off-skewer. And you have to go back and watch it a few times, which is great.
Which is sort of the same for most of Paul Anderson's films, I find. Yeah. You know, they've always got great soundtracks. They keep you involved the whole time. And when it's over, you think, oh no, is it ended now? You know, it could go on longer, and you've got to see it again and again.
Yeah, and
again.
I could watch it again and still find something else in it. You know, you've got Gene Hackman and Angelica Houston in it, and it's just the acting's great in it.
So, Paul, I asked if you'd seen any films recently that really impressed you, and you come up with a great choice here. Tell us about American Hustle.
I guess all my films have sort of got a common theme. You know, it's just great acting, great story. And this is like another, it's a great caper, isn't it? It's just, you know, con men going around trying to say, oh, you feel a lot of empathy for some reason. They're going around ripping people off.
They're likable people. They're likable rogues.
They're likable rogues. And you
which
want
is
them,
what we are, really.
You want them to succeed, don't you, for some reason, even though they're doing really horrible stuff to people and ripping them off. And I just thought the whole story, I think it sums up American cinema, this film, actually. Great acting, great direction, great screenplay, great wigs. And Christian Bale in it is great, and Jennifer Lawrence, and you just realise what great actors they've got in America. Yeah. Bradley Cooper, they was all fantastic in it. And I think it was a feel-good factor film as well. Yeah. You know, there's no violence in it, there's no darkness, and it was just a great all-round film, really.
Yeah, apparently when... Bale changed his appearance so much for the film. Yeah. Apparently Robert De Niro didn't even recognise him when he was introduced to him.
Yeah, amazing. Amazing, all that weight he put on and stuff. Did he win the... I think he won the Oscar, maybe.
It was the only film, as far as I can see, to be nominated in all seven major categories. That's Best Actor, Best Actress, Supporting Actor, Supporting Actress, Director, film, and I guess screenplay would be the seventh one.
Film. I didn't realise that it was
remarkable,
so well thought of.
I don't think it won them all, but...
Because I don't think it done very well over in the UK when it first came out. Probably done, it got great reviews, but I'm not sure if... I don't remember people raving about it and saying, oh, you got to go and see this. And it done okay, but I think it'll stand the test of time, that one. Yeah.
Absolutely. So let's go out with something from American Hustle. Paul, it's been great to chat to you today about these things, and thanks for clearing up some of my questions about the early days, and all the best with the professionals, and let's look forward to some more great films, huh?
Yeah, thanks very much. It's been fun, actually, yeah.
Something new.